Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 989. Hindutva Fascism Part 2, The Assassination of Mahatma Gandhi Part 2. This is being recorded on December 12th of the year 2017. We are going to plunge right back in where we left off at the end of For the Record 988. We have been talking about the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi and have been drawing on the vitally important book Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, copyright 2012 by James Douglas, and published in hardcover by Orbis Books. This is a very small and inexpensive and yet very important book. I emphatically encourage members of the listening audience to go ahead and get this book for their own use. It would also make an ideal gift for the holidays or for some, or at really any time. I get no money from this, nor do any of the radio stations that carry this program get any money from this whatsoever. I think understanding Gandhi's political methodology and the spiritual introspective discipline that lay at the core of that is fundamental, I think, in this very dark day and age. Now, we have been talking about the RSS. That is the Hindu Nationalist or Hindutva, H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A, fascist organization patterned after Mussolini's black shirts and demonizing Muslims as the malevolent, quote, other, unquote, as fascist groups do. That was the group that that was the organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi, the founder of the ideological kingpin of that organization, is V.D., as in Victor David Savarkar, S-A-V-A-R-K-A-R. He was the mastermind of the RSS plot against Gandhi, and his RSS and the closely associated Hindu Mahasabha organization, M-A-H-A-S-A-B-H-A, had heavily infiltrated the Indian government and the Indian security forces in particular. There had been an earlier attempt at killing Gandhi on January 20th of 1948, and a fellow named Madan Lal, M-A-D-A-N-L-A-L, Pawa, P-A-H-W-A, who was one of the conspirators, was captured and spilled the beans, the point being that the Indian authorities knew in advance that there was going to be a conspiracy against Gandhi's life, and they effectively did nothing. And then after the conspiracy, they covered, after the murder, I should say, of Gandhi, 10 days after the January 20th, 1948 unsuccessful attempt, the true facts were ultimately covered up. The Kapoor Commission, K-A-P-U-R, a parliamentary or an Indian governmental commission that was investigating Gandhi's assassination, uncovered much of this. The point being that the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi was very similar to the assassination of JFK. James Douglas also wrote the book JFK and the Unspeakable, why he died and why it matters, that we have used many times. Many people knew who was behind the assassination of Gandhi. There was deep complicity on the part of the Indian security apparatus, which had been infiltrated by the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha, and the Indian leadership, including Home Minister Patel and Prime Minister Nehru, were basically complicit in the cover-up of the participation of RSS kingpin V.D. Savarkar in the plot. Natarajan Godse, who was hung for the killing, was the personal secretary of V.D. Savarkar. We're going to I'll continue with this. This against the background, as we have seen in the past, of the fact that Steve Bannon was a big fan, is a big fan of Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, whose BJP party is a political front for the RSS, the Hindutva fascist organization that killed Gandhi and that we are looking at here. The ascension, the political ascension of Narendra Modi in India was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar, the financier of First Look Media and The Intercept. He also helped to finance the rise of some of the OUNB fascist successor organizations in Ukraine. And Tulsi Gabbard, who put Bernie Sanders' name into nomination at the Democratic Convention and was his prospective vice presidential candidate had he gotten the nomination, had much to do with arranging the American journey, visit of Narendra Modi. And when she traveled to India, she networked heavily with the RSS, the Hindutva fascist organization that murdered Gandhi and that is front and center in our discussion here. Narendra Modi is in the process of implementing some of the corporatist / neoliberal economics that are at the foundation of the economic landscape of fascist governments everywhere.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
So, with the unsuccessful January 20th, 1948 assassination plot against Gandhi, and with the arrest of Madanlal Pahwa, who disclosed many of the details, we're going to plunge right back in to where we left off. I'm going to overlap this discussion with the closing element of the discussion in For the Record 988. And again, we are reading from the vitally important book, I can't recommend it strongly enough, Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Douglas writes of the aftermath of the unsuccessful January 20th, 1948 attempt on Gandhi, 10 days before the successful attempt on Gandhi's life. Nathuram Godse, again the personal secretary to V.D. Savarkar and the eventual assassin of Gandhi. Nathuram, N-A-T-H-U-R-A-M, Godse, G-O-D-S-E, and Narayan Apte retreated to Bombay, where they succeeded in reuniting with their closest cohort, Vishnu Karkare, K-A-R-K-A-R-E. In the meantime, those whom Godse and Apte had left in charge of their newspaper, the Hindu Rashtra, reported the assassination attempt as the work of anti-Gandhi refugees. Hindu Rashtra's headline proclaimed, quote, representative reaction shown by enraged Hindu refugees against the appeasement policy of Gandhiji. Gandhiji is an affectionate, familiar name for Gandhi. The refugees here were alleged to be refugees. Well, there were a great many of them. These were Hindu refugees who fled from Pakistan after the partition. Continuing, fixing the blame for the murder attempt or from the standpoint of Gandhi's enemies, the credit on refugees was easy. The only conspirator seized by the police was Madanlal Pahwa. At the Delhi police station, Pahwa soon confessed the entire plot to his interrogators. He named for the police one of the conspirators whom he called Kirtri, K-I-R-K-R-E-E, his mentor, Karkare. In describing each of his six companions, he said one of them was a definitive identification of Nathuram Godse, whom he knew under the pseudonym Deshpande, D-E-S-H-P-A-N-D-E. Pahwa led the police to the room in the Marina Hotel where Godse and Apte, who were registered under S and N Deshpande, had held their final planning session with the others. When the police searched the room, they found in a drawer a typed press release from a Hindu Mahasabha leader, Ashutosh Lahiri, A-S-H-U-T-O-S-H-L-A-H-I-R-I, that repudiated, quote, his organization having signed the 9-point pledge required by Gandhiji, unquote. The press release said the Hindu Mahasabha was opposed to the basic policy of Mahatma Gandhi and his followers in regard to the treatment meted out to Muslim minorities in India. Here was an important clue that Pahwa's co-conspirators were linked with the Hindu Mahasabha. Laundry that the room's occupants had given to the hotel for washing included three items bearing the initials NVG, standing for Natarajan Vinayak Godse, and the importance of all this evidence identifying Gandhi's would-be assassins was underlined by a chilling statement Madanlal Pahwa made to the police, quote, they will come again, unquote. Natarajan Godse, in the company of Apte and Karkare, would fulfill Pahwa's prophecy to the police by shooting Gandhi to death on January 30th. How was that to happen? Incriminating, identifying information was in the hands of the police. Pahwa was warning that the killers would return. Moreover, Madanlal Pahwa had already divulged the plot to kill Gandhi the week before the conspirators even tried to carry it out. He had told his employer in Bombay, Professor J. C. James, J-A-I-N, about his upcoming role, quote, throwing a bomb, unquote, as a diversion at Gandhi's prayer meeting so that his associates could kill Gandhi. Jane thought Pahwa was just making up the story until he was shocked to read a January 21st newspaper article about Pahwa's arrest for the bombing incident. Jane then managed to meet with B. G. Kher, K-H-E-R, Premier of the province of Bombay, and Morarji Desai, M-O-R-A-R-J-I-D-E-S-A-I, Home Minister of the province of Bombay. He had succeeded in gaining the attention of the two most important government officials in Bombay on the urgent matter of Gandhi's impending assassination over a week before it was to happen. Jane informed the government leaders that he knew from Pahwa that the bombing was part of what appeared to be a big conspiracy, unquote, to kill Gandhi. Again, quoting, Madanlal had told me that the conspirators had formed a party which was to be financed by one Karkare, K-A-R-K-A-R-E, from Ahmed Nagar, A-H-M-E-D-N-A-G-A-R, who had visited him along with Pahwa. A further connection was Savarkar himself, who Pahwa said had met with him for 2 hours, raising the young Hindu refugee for exploits such as his attempt to dynamite the house of a Muslim. On hearing Jane's story, Home Minister Desai had, he said later, a strong feeling that Savarkar was behind the conspiracy, unquote. Desai said he passed on Jane's information that night to his Deputy Police Commissioner J.D. Nagarvala, N-A-G-A-R-V-A-L-A, ordering him first to, quote, arrest Karkare, unquote. Karkare had an outstanding warrant for his arrest in another case, but had not yet been found. Second, Desai, quote, ordered, quote, to keep a close watch on Savarkar's house and his movements, unquote. And third, quote, to find out as to who were the persons involved in the plot, unquote. Desai said he had also shared Jane's information on the plot the next day, January 22nd, 1948, in Ahmedabad with the Indian Union government's Home Minister, Vallabhai Patel, who was in charge of the national government's security apparatus. And Vallabhai is V-A-L-L-A-B-H-B-H-A-I Patel, P-A-T-E-L. He, along with Prime Minister Nehru, were arguably the two most important and the closest disciples of Gandhi, and both really helped to cover up the killing. By the way, as was the case with the first program, I am sure that I am butchering the pronunciation of many of these, probably just about all of these Indian names. And next, more about the complicity of the police. Bear in mind that the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha have heavily infiltrated the Indian security apparatus and furthered the plot. Pyarelal, P-Y-A-R-E-L-A-L, Gandhi's secretary, told the Kapoor Commission investigating Gandhi's assassination that, apart from the added officers, he, quote, could not say whether any special police precautions were taken after the bomb was thrown. However, he was certain of one thing, quote, Mahatma would have been protected if the police had arrested those persons about whom indications had been given in Madanlal's statement, unquote. Why didn't the police carry out such arrests? As of January 21st, both the Delhi police and the Bombay police had in their possession statements identifying key members of the ongoing conspiracy to kill Gandhi. Moreover, they were in touch with one another. Yet for 9 days, the assassins moved about freely until three of them, Apte, Godse, and Karkare, returned on the 30th of January to another prayer meeting in Delhi, where Godse then killed Gandhi. For that to happen without any intervening arrests to prevent the assassination, strange events had to occur, and they did. On January 21st, Delhi's Inspector General of Police, P. G. Sanjevi, S-A-N-J-E-V-I, sent two of his officers to Bombay to brief the Bombay Deputy Police Commissioner, J. D. Nagavala, N-A-G-A-R-V-A-L-A, on Pala's confession. The Delhi officers claimed that when they saw the Bombay Commissioner Nagavala on the next 2 days, he met with them only perfunctorily. In return, they simply gave him an English note on the case, which Nagavala denied having received. They did, quote, not only tell Mr. Nagavala what was within their knowledge about the conspiracy, including Pala's identification of the editor of the Pune newspaper, the Hindu Rashtra or Agrani, as another co-conspirator. That, by the way, was not from Ram Godse. Continuing. The officers told the commission nothing that they knew that would identify the assassins, nor did Nagavala share with them the contents of the statement he already had from Professor Jain that also identified Pawa, Karkare, as well as their association with Savarkar, unquote. All pointers to attempted political assassination by Savarkar's followers, unquote. Each police contingent acted as if they were obliged not to speak in a meaningful way, each claiming later that non-cooperation by the other was to blame for Gandhi's death. Nagavala told the two visiting officers that he had the investigation under control and ordered them to return to Delhi. In the meantime, Nagavala, Bombay's police commissioner, following Morjerai Desai's orders, were keeping what proved to be an ineffective watch on Savarkar's home. One more time. In the meantime, Nagavala's Bombay police, following Morarji Desai's orders, were keeping what proved to be an ineffective watch on Savarkar's home. Savarkar, of course, the founder of the RSS and the chief figure in the successful assassination conspiracy of Gandhi. Nagavala, quote, stated in his crime report number one that Savarkar was at the back of the conspiracy and that he was feigning illness and was wrongly giving out that he was out of politics, unquote. At this point, Gandhi had just 7 days left before his assassins would return. And more about the apparently lethal, the ultimately lethal disinterest on the part of the authorities. When the Delhi police officers returned from Bombay having achieved nothing, the Kapoor Report noted that they, quote, should have at once telephoned or telegraphed to the Pune police, giving them information about the editor of the Agrani and inquiring as to who he was, who his companions were, what his activities were, and what his haunts were, and should have made a requisition for their arrest. All they did was submit a report on their unsuccessful trip to Bombay. Gandhi had 5 days left to live. Also on January 25th, 5 days before Gandhi's killing, Delhi's Inspector General Sanjeevi met with Bombay's Deputy Inspector General U.H. Rana, R-A-N-A, who happened to be in Delhi at the time. Sanjeevi gave Rana a copy of Pala's most recent January 24th statement to the Delhi police to hand over personally to the Bombay police. Pala had by this time mentioned not only the editor of the Hindu Rashtra, Mataram Godse, but also its, quote, proprietor, unquote, or publisher, Apte, as his co-conspirators. Rana departed for Bombay on a mission that was late, but could still have saved Gandhi's life. However, he decided to go by train instead of air. He said later it was, quote, because he did not like flying, unquote. He also chose a very long train route to Bombay, taking him across half of India on a 36-hour train ride. During this time, Godse and Apte, who were to kill Gandhi, were actually in Bombay consulting with Savarkar and renewing their attempt to kill Mahatma Gandhi. When Rana finally arrived in Bombay on January 27th, Godse and Apte had just left by plane for Delhi. Gandhi had 3 days left to live. Rana then met with Commissioner Nagarwala. Rana said he showed, quote, the full statement of Madan Lal to Mr. Nagarwala, but took it back from him, and Mr. Nagarwala did not read it all the way through, unquote. The Kapoor Report observed that Nagarwala, quote, did not ask Mr. Rana as to the contents of the statement of Madan Lal, because Mr. Rama appeared to be satisfied with what he, Nagarwala, had already done. This is a rather peculiar statement because Mr. Nagarwala was working out the information given to him by Professor Jain, which had been conveyed to him by Mr. Morarji Desai, and Madan Lal's statement in Delhi would have been helpful in working out the information. By the way, Desai eventually became Prime Minister of India himself. Continuing, why did Rana not give Nagarwala the statement providing further information on Pala's co-conspirators in the plot to kill Gandhi? And why did Nagarwala not retain or copy the statement, or at the very least, read it through? When it came to identifying the editor and proprietor of the Hindu Rashtra, the ignorance and disinterest of the various police officials became even more puzzling. The Kapoor Commission discovered that the Indian government had this information in its files in Delhi all along. Copies of, quote, the annual statement of newspapers, unquote, had been sent to both the Home Department and the Information and Broadcasting Department of the Government of India. The newspaper named N. V. Godse as the editor and N. D. Apte as the proprietor of the Hindu Rashtra, described by the document as, quote, a Sarvarkarsh group paper, unquote. Inspector General T. G. Sanjeevi was also the director of the Intelligence Bureau, the highest police job in all of India. For the 10 days from Pawar's capture to Gandhi's assassination, the list that identified Godse and Apte with the Hindu Rashtra was only a few steps away from Sanjeevi in his own files. He never took those steps, nor did any other Indian police official. The Kapoor Report commented, quote, it would be unbelievable if that thing did not happen as it did, that Mr. U. H. Rana should have gone through the statement of Madan Lal along with Mr. Sanjeevi, as Mr. Sanjeevi's note shows, and neither of them should, on the 25th of January, have taken the slightest trouble to find out from the Intelligence Bureau or the Press Information Bureau who the proprietor or editor of the Hindu Rashtra actually was. Of course, that was Natarajan Godse, who killed Gandhi. Continuing, and so it went. In a police investigation marked by lethargy, delays, and official indifference toward tracking and arresting the men who were stalking Gandhi. Pawar said they would come back, and they did. The police, by their inaction, gave the assassins another chance. Why did they do that? The veil was lifted for a moment when Nagarwala was asked why he did not arrest Savarkar or detain him. Quote, his reply was that he could not do so before the murder, as that would only have caused commotion in the Maharashtrian region, but an upheaval. One more time. That his reply was that he could not do so before the murder, as that arrest would not only have caused commotion in the Maharashtrian region, but an actual upheaval, unquote. Nagarwala was admitting that before Gandhi's assassination, he saw Savarkar and his followers as too powerful to be stopped. From a police standpoint, allowing Gandhi's assassins to move about freely until they killed Gandhi was a concession to Savarkar's power. And next we are going to hear about an American who had traveled to India, a fellow named Vincent Sheehan, S-H-E-E-A-N, and he was talking with Gandhi. Gandhi basically told him that they basically foreshadowed his own death and indicated that he felt that he would be killed, and that really to unite India in harmony, to unite Muslims and Hindus in harmony, his, meaning Gandhi's, death would be necessary. Very much like Martin Luther King, who knew in Memphis on April 4th of 1968 that he was going to be killed, Gandhi knew he was going to be killed as well. Note also that Prime Minister Nehru, who along with Home Minister Patel were Gandhi's closest disciples and friends, actually did give a speech in which he identified the Hindutva fascist conspirators against Gandhi, but in a remarkable coincidence, the loudspeakers, the public address system, malfunctioned, and no one in the audience heard what Nehru had to say. I think that is an unlikely coincidence.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
On January 29th, Vincent Sheehan accompanied Jawaharlal Nehru to a mass meeting in Amritsar near India's northwest border with Pakistan. 400,000 people gathered in a park to hear their country's prime minister. Sheehan, from his spot near Nehru, was awed by the sea of humanity. He was also struck by what Nehru said in, quote, a speech of great political importance. It was the first time any member of the government of India had openly attacked the Hindu reactionary or proto-fascist organizations by name. Those organizations, the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha, were, within 24 hours, to take the life of Mahatma Gandhi, unquote. As a border city, Amritsar was filled with Hindu and Sikh refugees from Pakistan. Nehru's audience included a large number of people seething with revenge against Muslims whom they blamed for their plight. They were being egged on by the Hindu Mahasabha and RSS organizations that Nehru identified and attacked on the eve of Gandhi's murder. Nehru's speech was courageous, given at a critical juncture of history. Unfortunately, almost no one in the vast crowd heard it. In a strange turn of events, as Sheehan witnessed, quote, the loudspeaker apparatus failed, and not a word of Mr. Nehru's speech could be heard, unquote. Parenthetically, I suspect that was deliberate sabotage. As we have seen, the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha had deeply infiltrated all aspects of the Indian government, including and especially its security apparatus. Continuing. On Friday, January 30th of 1948, Gandhi's last day on Earth, Gandhi's secretary Pyarelal reported back to him the response of the Hindu Mahasabha president, Dr. Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, that's Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, as the formal head of Savarkar's organization, was a minister in Nehru's cabinet, a sign of the power that the forces the prime minister denounced in his unheard speech the night before had gained in his own government. This last sentence again. On Friday, January 30th, Gandhi's last day on earth, Pyarelal reported back to him the response of the Hindu Mahasabha president, Dr. Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, as the formal head of Savarkar's organization, was a minister in Nehru's cabinet, a sign of the power that the forces the prime minister denounced in his unheard speech the night before had gained in his own government. Gandhi had asked Mukherjee if he would please use his authority as the Mahasabha leader to put a curb on the activities of a Mahasabha worker, quote, who had been delivering highly inflammatory speeches containing incitement to assassination of some Congress party leaders, unquote. Pyarelal told Gandhi Dr. Mukherjee's halting, quote, halting, an unsatisfactory reply. It seems he had underestimated the seriousness of the danger represented by such irresponsible utterances and activities and the heavy toll that they would exact before long. Unquote. Gandhi's great-grandson, Tushar Gandhi, T-U-S-H-A-R, wrote about police complicity in the assassination. And we read of this. Judge Atma Sharan, that's Atma A-T-M-A, Sharan C-H-A-R-A-N, the presiding judge in the trial for Gandhi's murder, delivered a damning judgment concerning the police's role in abetting the assassination. Quote, I may bring to the notice of the central government the slackness of the police in the investigation of the case during the period between January 20th, 1948, and January 30th, 1948. The Delhi police had obtained a detailed statement from Madan Lal K. Pawa soon after his arrest on January 20th of 1948. The Bombay police have also been reported, had also reported the statement of Dr. J. C. Jain that he had made to the Honorable Morarji Desai on January 21st of 1948. The Delhi police and the Bombay police had contacted each other soon after these two statements had been made, and yet the police failed miserably to derive any advantage from these two statements. Had the slightest keenness been shown in the investigation of the case at that stage, the tragedy probably could have been avoided, unquote. Gandhi's great-grandson Tushar Gandhi has written about police complicity in the assassination. According to a secret report submitted to Home Minister Sardar Patel, many in the police force and many bureaucrats were secret members of the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha and were actively supporting and promoting the ideology of the Hindu extremist organizations. The measures taken by the police between the 20th and 30th of January of 1948 were more to ensure the smooth progress of the murderers than to try and prevent Gandhi's murder. And still quoting Gandhi's grandson, in hindsight, it can only be said that in Gandhi's murder, the police, by their negligence and inactions, were as much guilty as the murderers themselves. And again, bear in mind that the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha had deeply infiltrated the police. And now Nehru and Patel, Gandhi's two closest disciples and the Prime Minister and Home Minister of India, respectively, were also passively complicit because of their fear of what might happen if they stood up to Savarkar and the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha. Continuing with Gandhi and the unspeakable. To what degree were the government's leaders also responsible for Gandhi's death? The official in charge of security for Prime Minister Nehru, G. K. Handu, H-A-N-D-L-O, explained later to the Kapoor Commission in its investigation of Gandhi's assassination what should have been done to protect him from his assassins. Handu said the government had a security blueprint to follow in such matters. Given the identification of the conspirators provided by Pawa and Jain after the bomb explosion, Handu said that Bombay and Pune police officers, with their familiarity of Godse, Apte, and other co-conspirators, should have been enlisted as spotters. They should have been posted to watch for the assassins at the Delhi airport, railway stations, hotels, and other key Delhi locations, particularly at the Birla House during the prayer meetings. Two wings of plainclothes security police should have been formed to protect Gandhi, the first ring 2 or 3 yards from him, and the second ring 25 yards away. These were the kinds of standard government security measures carried out for the Prime Minister and other VIPs, especially in the context of the recognized threat. Gandhi, considered father of the nation, more than qualified for such security during the period of January 20th to 30th of 1948, when a co-conspirator in custody had said repeatedly that Gandhi's assassins would return. As MP questioner Rohini Chaudhuri, C-H-A-U-D-H-U-R-Y, pointed out to Patel, Gandhi's consent to security, quote, except in the case of body searches, was not required, nor was Gandhi adamantly opposed to a police presence. He had agreed, in deference to Nehru's and Patel's burden of responsibility, to whatever measures they thought necessary for his security, short of body searches. Quote, let them do whatever they like, Gandhi had said. Yet in the days between the bombing and Gandhi's murder, no such standard security measures were taken to protect him. Nehru and Patel did not deploy their security police as they would have done normally in such a situation, as was in fact done for themselves immediately after Gandhi's murder out of concern for their own lives. At a critical time, under a clearly identified threat, they failed to protect the life of the man they, their country, and the world most revered. And during the actual trial of the assassins, after the arrest of the assassins after killing Gandhi, first of all, Savarkar was basically allowed to remain silent, and Nataram Godse was allowed to read a 9-hour soliloquy, basically, justifying Gandhi's murder and vilifying Gandhi, returning to Gandhi and the unspeakable. Savarkar was among those charged with Gandhi's murder. Digambar Bhaj, who turned state's evidence, testified in the murder trial about Godse's and Apte's meetings with Savarkar. Savarkar, however, was found not guilty because of a lack of corroborative evidence. Godse and Apte protected Savarkar all the way to their executions, denying vehemently any connection with Savarkar in the conspiracy. Savarkar read a 57-page statement in his defense. In it, he told the story of his life, portraying himself as a self-sacrificing patriot. He flatly denied all the charges against him, and in conclusion, he cited statements he had made that he claimed showed his admiration and affection for Gandhi, the man whose killing he had planned. P.L. Inamdar, I-N-A-N-D-A-R, a defense lawyer who professed a great admiration for Savarkar, was taken aback by Savarkar's performance in defense of himself. Savarkar read out the statement in the court with all the gimmicks of an orator, bemoaning his fate of being charged with the murder of Mahatmaji by the independent Indian government, when he admired and eulogized the person of the Mahatmaji so sincerely and so often. Savarkar actually wiped his cheeks in court while reading this part of his oration, unquote. Although Savarkar was seated next to Godse in the defendant's dock, he totally ignored him and the other defendants. Savarkar knew it was to his legal advantage if he acted as if he bore no relation to his co-defendants, especially the confessed shooter of Gandhi. Godse told friends how he, quote, yearned for a touch of Savarkar's hand, a word of sympathy, or at least a look of compassion, unquote. Godse, the trigger man, maintained his loyalty to Savarkar to the gallows, proclaiming his mentor's innocence to the end. While Godse, in his courtroom speech of defense, derided the prosecutor because he, quote, painted me as a mere tool in the hands of Veer Savarkar, his teacher sat impassively, according to defense counsel Inamdar, like, quote, a sphinx sculpted in stone, unquote. Yet critics have maintained that Savarkar, in spite of his self-defensive public coldness toward Godse, was actually the composer of Godse's surprisingly eloquent written statement. It took Godse 9 hours to deliver his courtroom speech. Gandhi's great-grandson Tushar Gandhi observed, quote, the language of the statement leads one to the conclusion that much of it either flows directly from the pen of the master orator and wizard wordsmith V.D. Savarkar, or was definitely embellished by him. Savarkar possessed a magical command over the spoken and written word. Even if not entirely written by Savarkar, the final draft was surely worked on by him, converting it into a highly emotionally charged document. It was known that the accused were free to confer with each other in prison, and on several occasions, guards had been caught smuggling out messages from the accused. There is no reason to believe that Nataram was not able to get his mentor and Guru V. D. Savarkar to help him polish what is today referred to by Natharam's ideological offspring as his last will and testament, unquote. The fact that Judge Atma Charan, C-H-A-R-A-N, allowed Natharam Godse, Gandhi's confessed assassin, to speak for 9 hours in an ideological assault on Gandhi and a judicial defense of Savarkar shows just how much the court was subservient to the political power of Gandhi's murderers. Godse's speech condemned his murder victim for his, quote, submission to the Muslims' blows, unquote. Godse claimed he had to kill Gandhi for surrendering India to the Muslims, lest he, quote, lead the nation to ruin and make it easy for Pakistan to enter the remaining India and occupy the same, unquote. Gandhi's, quote, teachings of absolute ahimsa, Godse said, again quoting, would ultimately result in the emasculation of the Hindu community and thus make the community incapable of resisting the aggression or inroads of other communities, especially the Muslims, unquote. Godse contrasted Gandhi's teaching of nonviolence with the militant Hindu ideology of brave, quote-unquote, Savarkar, again quoting, the ablest and most faithful advocate of the Hindu cause, unquote. Godse, however, insisted repeatedly that Savarkar had nothing whatsoever to do with Gandhi's murder. Why did the judge allow this? Returning to Gandhi and the unspeakable. Why did the judge give Godse a courtroom platform from which he could launch an extended attack on the reputation of the man he had already shot to death? When Godse and, in effect, Savarkar were allowed to attack Gandhi in a 9-hour courtroom diatribe, the defendants became the prosecution. It was a clear prelude to Savarkar being declared not guilty by the judge. It was only after Savarkar's death in 1966 that the government commission reviewing Gandhi's assassination revealed that the corroborative evidence to convict Savarkar had been in the government's possession all along. On March 4, 1948, 3 months before the Gandhi murder trial began, Savarkar's bodyguard, APPA, Ramchandra, R-A-M-C-H-A-N-D-R-A, Kassar, K-A-S-A-R, and his secretary, Bhajanan Vishnu Donle, B-A-G-A-N-A-N, V-I-S-H-N-U-D-A-M-L-E, gave recorded statements to the Bombay police confirming that meetings between Savarkar, Godse, and Apte had in fact taken place before the assassination. Savarkar bodyguards Kassar and Donley also revealed that Savarkar had additional meetings in January with the other indicted co-conspirators, Karkare, Pahawa, Badge, and Parshure. Justice J. L. Kapoor, who chaired the Commission on Gandhi's murder, observed in his 1970 report, quote, all this shows that people who were subsequently involved in the murder of Mahatma Gandhi were all congregating sometime or the other at Savarkar's Sadan and sometimes had long interviews with Savarkar. It is significant that Karkare and Madanlal Pawa visited Savarkar before they left for Delhi, and Apte and Godse visited him both before the bomb was thrown and also before the murder was committed on the 30th, and on each occasion they had long interviews. Bombay Police Commissioner Nagarwala, who acted with so little urgency while Gandhi was still alive, stated in a letter on January 30, 1948, that in the wake of Gandhi's assassination, he had arrested Kassar, Savarkar's bodyguard, and Donley, his secretary. Nagarwala learned from them that Godse and Apte had met with Savarkar for 40 minutes, quote, on the eve of their departure to Delhi, unquote, a critical meeting in addition to those identified by Badge, Kassar, and Donnelly, quote, had admitted that these two, God say an update, had access to the house of Savarkar without any restriction. When summarizing evidence tying Savarkar to the plot, Justice Kapoor stated in his report, all these facts together were destructive of any theory other than the conspiracy to murder Gandhi by Savarkar and his group, unquote. Home Minister Patel and Prime Minister Nehru soon learned that Savarkar was behind Gandhi's murder. Less than this last statement again. Home Minister Patel and Prime Minister Nehru, parenthetically Gandhi's two closest disciples, soon learned that Savarkar was behind Gandhi's murder. Less than a month after the assassination, Patel wrote to Nehru, quote, it was a fanatical wing of the Hindu Mahasabha directly under Savarkar that hatched the conspiracy and saw it through, unquote. Yet government prosecutors never called to the murder trial's witness stand either Savarkar's bodyguard, Kassar, or his secretary, Donnelly. Their statements would have corroborated and added to Badger's testimony regarding Savarkar's meetings with Godse and Opte. Neither did the prosecution cite from the interviews Kassar and Donnelly had given to the police on the Savarkar-Godse-Opte meetings. The prosecution ignored these two key witnesses and their recorded information. Their testimony would have closed the government's conspiracy case against Savarkar. So why did the government hold back critical evidence that would have convicted Savarkar? I think you can guess the answer. Continuing, a revealing exchange occurred in the Gandhi murder trial when witness Morarji Desai, the Bombay government's home minister, was cross-examined by Savarkar's lawyer. Desai was testifying on what Professor Jain had told him after Paula's arrest for the January 20th attempt to kill Gandhi. Paula told Jain earlier that Savarkar was involved in the plot. Desai said he then ordered the police to place a watch on Savarkar's house. Savarkar's attorney asked Desai, quote, did you have any other information about Savarkar besides Professor Jain's statement for directing steps to be taken as regards him? Desai responded, shall I give the full facts? I am prepared to answer. It was for Savarkar himself to decide, unquote. Savarkar's defender withdrew the question. He asked the judge to delete that exchange from the record, as well as his motion to delete. The judge complied, and the judicial record was sanitized. Why did Morarji Desai, a government official who would himself eventually become India's prime minister, defer to the defendant, Savarkar, rather than simply, quote, give the full facts, unquote, about the further evidence Desai had on Savarkar? Why was it, quote, for him, Savarkar, the defendant, to, quote, decide what Desai, the government officer in charge of the investigation, was prepared but was reluctant to testify? This courtroom encounter, deleted from the trial record but reported by the Times of India journalist in attendance, suggests the unspeakable power that Savarkar retained even as Gandhi's charged assassin. The looming possibility that Savarkar would be convicted on the evidence threatened the government prosecuting him. It was for Savarkar himself to decide what future Prime Minister Desai should say on the witness stand. Tushar Gandhi, Gandhi's great-grandson, citing Patel, concluded that Savarkar was acquitted, quote, because of an unspeakable political necessity. Patel had admitted that the government had, quote, annoyed the Muslims, and we could not afford to annoy the Hindus, too. If Savarkar had been found guilty and sentenced, it would have caused a massive Hindu extremist reaction, which the Congress Party was scared of facing. And eventually, when the BJP came to power, it completely rehabilitated the political reputation of Savarkar. As Patel and Nehru should have learned from Gandhi's insistence that the truth is always paramount, their government's unwillingness to pursue the truth in his death would not lay a solid foundation for the country. The newly independent government's deliberate failure to convict Savarkar of Gandhi's murder gave Savarkar's followers a freer hand in revising his image. Since Savarkar's own death in 1966, a broader movement has risen from his ideology. The RSS, which slavishly followed Savarkar and whose member Natarajan Godse shot Gandhi to death, has become the second largest political movement in the world after the Chinese Communist Party. Using Savarkar's ideology of Hindutva, the RSS created a cluster of Hindu nationalist groups. The RSS family includes the BJP, which became the driving power of India's coalition government from 1998 to 2004. And parenthetically, the BJP and Narendra Modi are in power today. Once the BJP took power through a ruthless anti-Muslim strategy, it set out to rewrite history. BJP writers revised school textbooks to convey a Hindu nationalist slant in the history of India. Some things were better left unsaid. The new history books simply omitted Gandhi's murder by RSS member Godse. The BJP also used its power in Delhi to revise the dark history of its ideological source, recreating Savarkar as a brave patriot. On May 4, 2002, BJP leader L.K. Advani, who had become the government's home minister, officially renamed Port Blair Airport in the Andaman Islands as Veer Savarkar Airport, unquote. The government then unveiled a plaque in honor of Savarkar at the site of his cell at Port Blair. In 2003, the government placed Savarkar's portrait in the central hall of Parliament House in New Delhi. The BJP was trying to transform Savarkar in the public mind from the mastermind of Gandhi's murder into a mythical liberator of their country. And also in the written description, we will not have time to include it in this program, but there is discussion of how Mr. Suhrawardi, the Muslim ally of Mahatma Gandhi and one of the people targeted in the January 20th, 1948 plot, became a prime minister of Pakistan and basically sought to have Pakistan become a democratic country. Ultimately, he was threatened and driven out of the country and died under very strange circumstances, almost certainly being murdered himself.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
And that, again, is in the written description for the program. This concludes For the Record program number 989, Hindutva Fascism, Part 2, The Assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, Part 2, being recorded on December 12th of 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.